Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. Times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, December the 18th, 2025. This is episode 3778, and it is the last episode of the Survival Podcast expert panel for 2025. We do have one more, they call it brand new live type episode of the show, which will come out Monday, which is the same day that the AI course goes on sale. One more reminder, if you want a shot at that AI course, you absolutely need to go to jackslaws.com right now. Up at the top, you'll see a little message, a little banner right up at the top of the site. Click on that and pre-register. If you do not do that, there is no way on God's green earth you even have an opportunity to possibly maybe somewhat come even close to getting in. We've done this course twice now. It's sold out in literally under 2 minutes both times. Everybody that's taken it said within the first 2 weeks they got their money, and it's an 8-week-long course. It's really cool. More details, again, are at jackslaws.com. If you do not get registered, you are not getting in. You'll be waiting till March. I'll put it that way. We're going to be running it multiple times in 2026, but it'll be March before round two happens. Next up, I want to just really kind of state the obvious. My voice is dog shit today. You can probably tell listening to it. What I'm doing, I'm getting a much closer gait to the microphone than I usually do and talking at a much lower voice register than I do to try to preserve what's left of it. I didn't do any big speaking events, didn't do any crazy karaoke singing or anything. I got some kind of crud. I've been told by a lot of people that I know that have gotten the flu this year that the flu this year is bad. So either it's not bad to me or I got something else. I don't know what it is, but the last couple of days I've started to get really congested, choking stuff up, all of that good stuff. And man, last night my throat was just aching, and I could barely get to sleep because until I took something for it, I couldn't breathe through my nose at all. So I'm going to be talking less than typical in an expert panel show today. In between where I add commentary to kind of just hold off on that. I'll just do mostly just bridges, maybe one or two little comments here and there. But I do have an anchor segment for you guys anyway, one I can do quickly, just highlight and let you know about something. I thought that'd be a good compromise other than me just not doing an anchor segment today. So what do we got today? Well, we have from Chris Versini and Dr. Ron Paul a question that I don't think anybody's asking. We just had two National Guardsmen killed in Syria. They were sent home on a plane, and Trump went to Joint Air Force Base Andrews, as a president should in this situation, to see the transfer over, and I think to meet with some family members. And when you serve in the military, there is a chance that you end up dead. I mean, that's just reality, and it doesn't always even involve places like Syria or active combat or war zones. I was only in the military for about 3 years, and I personally knew two people that died, in one in more of a training accident and one more in a just kind of run-of-the-mill accident in a motor pool situation. So I've seen that happen. In fact, I also know two that ended up crippled really, really bad from accidents in Honduras, truck drivers. So it's a dangerous job. But there's a question that no one's asking when these two people are being sent home and to be laid to rest. Why the hell are United States military personnel in Syria, full stop? Dr. Paul and Chris Versini will talk about that. Andy McCann and Dr. Bones are both going to talk about eyesight issues. I stacked them back to back here because I thought it was interesting that these two kind of came in at the same time. Andy has a question about, is there anything you can do to fix your eyesight? If you're having, like, your eyesight wane, can you strengthen your eyesight at all? Or, if like, once the vision loss is there, is it just corrective lenses or surgery? And I think that's an interesting question, and I think Andy's got a good answer for it. Then I got another question right after that for Doc Bones. And this is something I know a lot about, so I'm going to listen to Bones' answer with you, and I might add a little bit because I have lazy eye. I have lazy eye to the point where the vision in my left eye is 20/200. That's legally blind. My range of vision is about 35 to 40 degrees in that eye, and I literally can't see anything out of it unless I fully block light to my right eye. my dominant eye. It's so mismatched that I don't even, like, I'm holding my left hand in front of my left eye right now, and I do not see it. If I super focus, I can sort of see it. If I close my left eye, I can see it. Very blurry, but I can see it. So I have some personal understanding of this issue, and I know that doctors, specifically eye doctors, are better about recognizing it early and how they treat it, but I'm interested in what Bones has to say about it. Joel Riles will talk about training your dog to go potty on demand, and I might say a word or two about why you'd want to. There were some people that were pretty impressed with the fact that I have Belle and Lucy both trained that way at the workshop, because it's like an on-demand dump switch, and there's sometimes that's really useful. Mike Molito will talk about choosing a first-year rifle for a young person, and in this case, a girl. I don't think there's that big of a difference in choosing a rifle for a youngster when you're talking like the 10 to 12-year-old range between a female and a male. The body differential, this, you know, the things that would really, really matter there haven't really started to happen that heavily yet. But, you know, when you get into that 16, mid-teens, like there's a big difference in boys and girls. So I don't even remember the age of the girl, so we'll see how Mike answers that and if I have anything I can throw in on it. Gary Brown will talk about foraging thistle, which I was totally familiar with, and something else called teasel, which I'd never heard of until this, but they're very very similar in certain ways, and they actually both have significant uses. I know a lot of people hate thistle, and there's good reason to, but there's also some good from it. And then my little short segment today is going to be on a new app I just found. It's called Fish Brain, like F-I-S-H, Fish Brain. I love this little app. It is for finding places to fish, and it's specifically geared toward bank fishing and maybe kayaks. This is not something that I think is really, really highly geared toward people with boats and sonars and stuff. There are some marked spots in it for that, but this is really great for the person who wants to be able to throw some rods in their truck or their car and drive out somewhere and just find a place to fish. It's like social media meets a fishing spot app. And there's some really cool features in it that I'll tell you about when we get to it. Real quick, before I start the experts lineup, just want to remind you, this time of year when you're doing your online shopping, please consider starting at tspaz.com. That's all I ask. Just go to tspaz.com before you start your shopping, and no matter what you buy, you'll help us out. But I have a really great lineup of items of the day for you guys this week. We have the Olight Arcfield Ultra EDC flashlight. Man, the thing's on sale right now for 25% off. It's a not an inexpensive light, but it is the best light I've ever used, and the way it carries is just amazing. It's also a lifetime warranty, and you know, in your first part of the purchase anyway, you've got immediate return options with Amazon, or if you did get a bad one, they'll swap it for you like the same day. Barinas LED grow light 6-packs, those are on sale right now. Time to get ready for your planning, your spring planning. We did a whole show on that this week. The Olatin's TO58 folding titanium scalpel, that is a great tool, would make a great gift, very inexpensive as a gift. The book by Henry Ford, My Life and Work, this is one of the most fascinating reads I've ever done. And the Anker Soundcore V20i open-ear headphones are still on sale for $25. Like, if you have, like, one of those gift exchange parties or something you have to go to, this would be a great item for that without, you know, breaking the bank or anything. I don't think too many people are still doing the white elephant thing at $10. Those days, if they are, you should tell them, hey, 1998 called and they wanted you to know to update your shit, right? All right, with that, let's go ahead and start hearing from our expert panel today, starting off with Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul. What the hell are U.S. troops even doing in Syria?
Assad has to go. Assad has, and he's gone.
He's gone. He's
so,
gone.
So who won? Did I don't know. I can't remember any Americans worrying about Assad, but they better start worrying about Americans dying in Syria because we have troops there.
Well, this is a terrible tragedy, and made all the worse by when you actually personalize it. When it stops being two troops and an interpreter, but when it starts being actual human beings that you can identify with. Now, this is the New York Post. If you put that first clip up, this is came out yesterday. Grieving Iowa police chief reveals son was one of three U.S. soldiers killed in Syria. Quote, cruel world. An Iowa police chief has posted a heartbreaking post identifying his son as one of the three Iowa Army National Guard soldiers killed in an ISIS attack in Syria. So, as you point out, Dr. Paul, these are not even regular military. These are Army National Guard who should be guarding the U.S. I'll go to that next one. In a press conference Sunday morning, Iowa Army National Guard Major General Stephen Osborne said the attack was carried out by a lone ISIS gunman who was later killed by partner forces. At the time of the attack, U.S. personnel were conducting a key leader engagement. So remember that. That was the official line, Dr. Paul. He was killed by a lone ISIS gunman, and we're told that we're over there taking care of ISIS. But guess what? As is often the case, the official narrative is undermined by reality. Now go to the next one. This is also antiwar.com. This is Dave Bekant, the robot. No, it wasn't a lone ISIS gunman. Dave writes, gunman who killed three Americans in Syria was a member of Syrian government security forces. He was in one of the government security forces, according to the Syrian Interior Ministry. So, according to Syria's own government, it was a government troop who shot and killed those three Americans, Dr. Paul. So, no, it wasn't a lone ISIS gunman. It was people that were in the Syrian military, a person in the Syrian military who took the shot.
Along with this, with what you said, from Defense Priorities, they had a statement put out about this. This sort of, I thought, was a significant summary of what's going on. And it goes, the only reason ISIS was able to strike U.S. troops in Syria is because we senselessly left them in harm's way.
Yes.
And long after their mission was completed, yeah, I don't know, what was their mission? We must not compound this tragedy by allowing U.S. troops to remain vulnerable to attack on a nebulous mission with no end date. The U.S. should withdraw all forces from Syria and Iraq and let those countries manage their own problems. That's to the point.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Unfortunately, they're not going to pay any attention to those of us who want to bring our troops home.
The answer to the Central Corps question of why do we have military troops in Syria is there is no good nor any legitimate answer to the question. Of all the places that we do not need to be, Syria is at the top of the list. And by the way, for the record, I wasn't a fan of Assad, but he was about 1,000 times better than the actual literal terrorist, and I mean literal terrorist, that Israel and the United States worked together to put in charge of the country where we now have a military presence that serves us no benefit whatsoever, and the nation we're supposedly, I guess, somehow aligned with, is killing our own personnel. So the answer is there is no good answer, and there is no legitimate reason, and it shouldn't be. But this will get almost no press. In fact, what you just heard is probably more than you will hear about this on mainstream media, and by Monday you won't even hear it mentioned ever again, unless there's some way to tie it into something completely different and try to make a case for the state's bullshit. Next up, I'm going to just play these back to back. These are two questions on eyesight. Andy McCann's question is more general in nature, like if you are getting older and your eyes are declining in performance. You hear it all the time, I need a scope because of my old eyes. Don't say that, just say you want a fucking scope, guys. But you do hear that, right? And there is a reason for it. We do have declining performance in our vision across time. Is there anything you can do to forestall that or improve it? And then Doc Bones has another thing. This is the opposite end of things. This is a problem you're born with called lazy eye. What is it? And what can be done about it, and what are the limitations as to what can be done about it? Let's go ahead and hear from both of those gentlemen now.
Hello and good morning, guys. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. You can find more about what I do and what I'm talking on if you go to my podcast, Food Fitness Finance, or go to YouTube at AndyMcCann42. You'll see a bunch of stuff there. Anyway, I got a very interesting one from Tommy and said, hey, what can I do to fix my vision? Can you exercise your eyes? So that is a great one. The short answer is maybe. So this is something that's actually near and dear to my heart. I've got optometrists in the family, and I've got eyes that need reading glasses. So what can you do? Here's what I would recommend. Go on to Google or YouTube or whatever. find a bunch of things that you would like to try and try them. The one that I have found that has been most effective for me, there's a lot of ones you can do, and I'll go through a couple of them. The one that's been most effective for me is the idea of lifting with your eyes. And what I mean by that is stare at something close, like a computer screen, and then look at something way far away, like a football field away, or maybe double that, right? So 200 or something yards away. Focus in, and then move over and focus in. Focus, focus. Go back and forth. You, if you're like me, you'll actually feel your eye going like womp, womp, womp as it shifts. I like can feel my eye doing something. That is what I consider lifting. So you're going for a short rep and then a long rep. And what you're trying to do is flex the muscles in your eye to get them to work out. Because here's the similarity. If I sit in a chair all day and do nothing, your body is going to adapt muscular-wise to that position. Your tendons are going to shift down or get smaller. Your muscles are going to atrophy, whatever, right? So you are a sitting human, and your body will adapt to that. So same thing with your eyes. If you're always looking at a computer screen or at your phone, right, and you're not really doing a lot of heavy lifting, like looking out to the distance, then your eyes are going to relax to that. So some of the idea behind that is the muscles in your eyes relax. Yes, it is true. You could have other things, something wrong with your lens or all those other stuff. I get it. I know. I'm just saying this is the one that I have found helpful for me. Well, what I'll do is at a stoplight, I'll look at my steering wheel, and then I'll look up into the distance. Steering wheel, distance, and let my eyes actually focus in on a thing. So, I don't know, let's say it's a billboard that's pretty far away. I'm looking at a specific spot on the billboard that I want to zero in on, and then I'm looking back at my steering wheel at a specific spot, like the seam or something like that. It doesn't have to be any of those. I'm just saying, if you go from very close to very far, you will feel your eye working. It will make it tired, and it doesn't take long to do. I don't know, do it for like 60 seconds and see how it goes for you. Measure the difference. There's a lot of other things they'll tell you to do that I just don't find that super effective. And I don't know, it doesn't make as much sense to me. Like, hey, blink your eyes rapidly for 60 seconds. I know, it's supposed to increase the blood flow. I just don't buy that. There's another good one. They'll say, as you do this box breathing, you know, like you breathe in for 4 seconds and then hold for 4 seconds. Same thing with your eyes. You're going to like go across the top of your vision for 4 seconds, like nice and slow, and then down the right, nice and slow, then back over the bottom, nice and slow, and then back up, nice and slow. So you're making a box with your eyes. Again, I don't find that very effective. It sometimes gives me a headache. Now, what you should never do is do any of these like cues that are like, look way, way, way far to the right. If you feel yourself straining with your eyes, that's not good. Don't strain it. The other one that I thought was interesting, but I still don't find super effective, is they'll tell you to make a figure eight with your eyes. So with your vision, look out into the horizon and just try to make your eyes do like a figure eight, or look at something close. You know, you could trace a figure eight if you can't make your eyes do it. Trace a figure eight with your eyes, you know, draw it on a piece of paper and make your eyes follow that. That's another good one. The other one that I feel has the most validity, but it looks stupid, so I don't do it, is you can get glasses with pinholes in them and you look through the pinholes. What it's doing, I don't really know, but I know a lot of people talk about that one. So basically you can take just any set of glasses, put a piece of paper over it, poke a little hole in there, and look through the pinholes. Or I'm going to actually link this over to Jack, and then he can put it on the show notes. It's this guy right here. It's a just glasses with holes in them. And I don't know, it kind of looks like your eyeballs now is a fly. It's got all those little dots all over the place. Supposedly this helps train too. I don't know why it would, besides you're constricting your pupil to go like look smaller. I don't know. But almost everywhere you look, and when I talk to other optometrists, they say this thing actually does do the job. So I'll link it and you guys can check it out. They're $20 for a set of two glasses. And I would say, though, the biggest thing you could do is look far, look short, far, short, far, short, and let your eyes adjust so you could actually see what you're looking at, not just go back and forth, back and forth. Let your eye dial in to whatever it is you're looking at. All right, guys, that is an unusual one. It is, I guess, health and fitness and exercise. You're exercising your eyeballs. But It goes along with the principle, if you don't do it, you will lose it. Your body will adapt to what stimulus you're giving it. And if you're giving it super close visual, it's just going to adapt to that. All right, guys, y'all take care.
Hi, Joe Alton, MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award winner in medicine, the fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. This week's question comes from Becky, who writes, "What is lazy eye? My seven-month-old grandson was diagnosed with the lazy eye. The doctor has him wear an eye patch over one eye for 3 hours a day and will recheck it in a month. Can you explain the eye patch and how this helps? Thank you, Becky." Becky, lazy eye, scientifically known as amblyopia, is a vision development disorder in which one eye fails to develop and achieve normal visual acuity even with corrective lenses. It's the leading cause of vision loss in children, affecting up to 3% of the population. So what happens in amblyopia? From birth until about age 8, a child's eyes and brain form vital connections. Anything that blocks or blurs vision in one or both eyes can slow down and prevent these connections from forming. Now, if that happens, the brain might not fully recognize the images it sees. The brain learns to ignore the images seen by the eye in question, and it becomes weaker, losing vision strength over time. That eye is referred to as amblyopic or lazy. So what causes a lazy eye? Eye misalignment, also called strabismus, is one possibility. The eyes do not line up in the same direction, maybe crossed or appear to wander. Now, this normally causes a double vision situation, but that's something the brain doesn't want. So to avoid it, the brain suppresses the image from the misaligned eye. Another possible cause is refractive error. A significant difference in acuity, let's say nearsightedness, farsightedness, maybe astigmatism, occurs between the two eyes. And if that happens, if one eye is stronger than the other, the brain favors the eye with a clearer image, ignoring the blurry one. And the worst case is deprivation, a physical obstruction that blocks light from entering the eye, such as being born with a cloudy lens, that's called a cataract, you may have heard of that, or a droopy eyelid, a condition called ptosis. This is the most severe, and luckily it's the least common type. Now, can you tell this is a problem before an eye professional checks it? Well, maybe. Symptoms can be hard to notice, and kids often, well, they don't complain because they adapt to the vision in their stronger eye. Possible signs include poor depth perception, an eye that wanders inward or outward, like I mentioned, or eyes that do not appear to work together, squinting or tilting the head to see better, rubbing one eye frequently, and these are all things that could alert you that maybe a routine vision screening is a good idea. So how is lazy eye treated? The goal of treatment is to force the brain to use the weaker eye so that the nerve pathways develop properly. The earlier treatment begins, the better the outcome, with optimal results occurring if treated before 7 years, although some improvement is possible in older children and teens. Treatment options include corrective eyewear. Glasses or contact lenses to correct near or farsightedness sometimes resolves the lazy eye entirely. Eye patches. Placing an opaque patch over the stronger eye for several hours each day forces the brain to rely on the weaker eye, strengthening the vision. It's important to have the patch be as opaque as possible. Medicated eye drops. Drops of a drug called atropine placed in the stronger eye can temporarily blur vision, which serves the same purpose as a patch, without the physical discomfort or the social stigma of a little kid walking around with an eye patch. In rare cases, surgery may be needed to correct underlying causes, such as removing a cataract, fixing a droopy eyelid, or realigning eye muscles to correct strabismus. Surgery alone, however, doesn't treat the amblyopia, the lazy eye itself, which usually still requires follow-up with patching or drops. There are also newer methods, including special computer programs and virtual reality headsets, to encourage both eyes to work together. This is called dicoptic therapy, and it's receiving wider acceptance. Becky, there you have it. With such an early diagnosis at 7 months, the odds of success in treating lazy eye is very high. Now, for a deeper dive into this subject, check out my website at doomandbloom.net, where I go into more detail into the anatomy of the eye and other issues related to this problem in my latest article. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, use your FSA, HSA accounts before the end of the year at our store at AltonFirstAid.com or store.doomandbloom.net to get some of the very best one-of-a-kind medical kits to keep your family safe in troubled times. You'll be glad you did.
So number one, the glasses with the holes in them that Andy talked about. I have those linked in the show notes for today. On the stuff from Bones, I will tell you, 7 months old, you definitely want to begin working on this. And had we known when I was a little kid what we know today, and had my lazy eye been picked up at, prior to being 1 year of age, instead of not until like 5 years old as I'm going into kindergarten, then I probably would have much better vision today, and I wouldn't have this legitimate handicap. And I think I've mentioned this on the air, but about a year or so ago, I had this dream, a weird dream, one of these waking dreams where you know you're dreaming, but in this dream, I was able to see out of both eyes. My brain was able to superimpose something into my mind that gave me the illusion of seeing out of both eyes. Until that happened, I never knew what a big deal this was. I never understood my loss. I never felt the loss. I knew that, for instance, like in competitive martial arts, it was a huge disadvantage. As soon as an opponent's coach picked up on it, then it would immediately be utilizing that blind spot. But overall, I drive, I'm a good shot, I'm a great shot with a rifle and a bow and a handgun. I do all the things. I have no real limitations as far as I'm concerned, other than backing a trailer because it's very difficult for me to use both mirrors. That's about it. I've always driven with my head slightly turned, and that expands my field of vision. I turn a little bit to my left, but that gives me the broadest field of vision across the front of the car. I've never had an accident in a vehicle because of my vision. I've never been injured, really. I've walked into a tree once or twice, I guess, like a low-hanging branch, but that's about it. When I had that dream, it was a blessing and a curse. I know what I'm missing, but I know what I'm missing. And so I would tell you, if it can be avoided, it should be avoided. And he said an opaque patch. I want to be really clear about what, because I had a conversation with Bones about this before he did this segment. I want to be very clear about what that means. When I was a kid, the patch was opaque. It was a piece of plastic that clipped onto the lens of your right eye. There is a problem here, and no one would listen to me when I was a little kid, and I was a little bit late in the game anyway at 5. And when you're a little kid and nobody listens to you, eventually you stop caring about doing the thing they're telling you to do, so I didn't even bother to keep doing it. The problem with that setup is light floods in to your right eye, and you still have a dominance issue, and what you end up seeing is the back of the patch and the lens of the glasses and the frames of the glasses. So it doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And at 5 years old, I didn't understand that. I just knew it didn't work, and it was very frustrating. What you need is like a pirate patch. You need something that closes off, not just because it's opaque, but because it's up against the eye socket. And does this look a little weird for a kid to walk around with? Sure. That's why you should do it when they're like, 2, 3, 4, however you can figure out how to get a kid not to yank it off their head. Like, at any point that they're old enough to be reasoned with anyway, because no one really makes fun of a 3-year-old, and a 3-year-old doesn't understand being made fun of anyway. And once you go off to school, yes, you look like a freaking doofus. However, it's a few hours a day. That means even a kid in that age range could do it at home. Let's say he wakes up in the morning, make him get ready with it on. Make him get ready for school with it on. When he walks out the door, take it off. When you get home from school, wear it for a couple hours. Anything is better than doing nothing. Because Bones hit it dead on. It is that in some way there is a conflict between the two eyes. In my case, it was astigmatism. And it was minor astigmatism in both eyes, but drastically different astigmatisms. And so the brain makes a choice. Which one of my optic nerves am I going to develop here? Because I can't do both. And so that's why it is uncorrectable after a certain age. Because it's not a problem with the eye, it's the nerve. And if the nerve doesn't develop, there's nothing you can do to make the nerve develop yet anyway. So, I can't get laser eye surgery or any of that shit to do anything about it. And this matters to me more than it ever did. because now I know what I don't have, and if that can be prevented for a young person as they grow up, I would prefer that. I also know that doing it the way I just described works, because my goddaughter and niece, Meyer, was diagnosed at about 2 years of age. They realized that he had that wandering eye, and that's that wandering one's always the weak one. And they went with the exact approach I gave, a fully up-against-the-eye eye patch. I advised them of that. Their doctor, even a couple of years ago, did the same thing with wear glasses and put the, no. And they actually listened. And she has, you know, not perfect vision, but her improvement in vision in her left eye between the age of about 3 to the age of 7 was roughly, she went from like a 21/40 to like a 20/70. That is it's like 50% better, you know? Like, that is a massive improvement. So, I know it works. Unfortunately, I didn't know at the time what could you expect from a 5-year-old kid, but I know now, and it's important to me that you guys know as well. That's why I wanted to make sure this got on as soon as it came in. Next, we're going to hear from Joel Riles about training your dog to potty on command. Setting the dog up with a dump button.
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you again with another expert counsel question. And today's question is about getting a dog to go to the bathroom where you want them to. And specifically in this situation, what's happening is the dog's being taken out multiple times, but it's not going to the bathroom. Sometimes it holds it up to 2 days. And they want to know, how do we get the dog to go to the bathroom? Also, kind of a contingency on this is the dog is associating the word go potty with getting excited and getting to go outside and play. All right, so let's break this down into a couple categories. Number one is when I go to take the dog outside, I would not start with like, oh, let's go potty before I go outside, right? Because that's going to start associating go potty means we get to go outside. I would tell the dog something like foos, which means to come up to my side, or I would do something like sit, put the dog in a sit, clip them in, put them to my side, and then say foos up, let's go, whatever you want to say, go to the door, seats. We talked about this in one of the ones I just did a couple weeks ago. And going through the door, having the dog sit, closing the door behind me, and walking with them under obedience to the spot I want them to go to the bathroom in. And then once we get there, then I say, get busy is what we use, or go potty, or whatever command you want to use for your dog to be able to use the bathroom. What that will do is it will start to disassociate just going outside with the command that you want to use for the dog using the bathroom. So that's step number one. I keep the dog in obedience, at least some level of obedience, right? It doesn't have to be quite as strict as I just described, but the more obedience you can put into your dog, the less of these types of problems you're going to have. Then, when I get to the spot that I want my dog to go to the bathroom, I'm not going to walk around with them. This is a classic mistake that a lot of people make when they let their dogs use the bathroom, especially if you want your dog to be able to go to the bathroom on lead or on command. Is I walk out to the spot I want them to go to the bathroom. I have them on their lead. I'm holding the end of the lead, so they have about 5 or 6 feet of distance around me. They can move around. I tell them to go get busy or go potty or whatever command you want to use, and then I let them have that range, but not any farther. I don't walk around. I don't do anything like that. I just stand where I want them to go, and I let them move all the way around me. I hand the lead kind of behind my back and stuff like that, or you can turn with them, but you can start getting dizzy depending on how much your dog wants to circle you, and I stay there until they use the bathroom. Now, if I take them out and they don't go to the bathroom, one of the things you can try to do is just tether them to that spot. Right? So if there's a small tree or a fence post or something like that, you can tether them there and then just go back inside and keep an eye on them. And pretty soon you'll see they'll start sniffing around. And if they have to use the bathroom, they'll go to the bathroom. As soon as you see them go to the bathroom, whether you're back inside or whether you're out there with them, you need to praise them. The praise when they go to the bathroom is what locks that command in. Now, it's not going to happen the first time. You're going to have to do this over and over again. But they will start, it'll click in the dog's mind. Oh, when I go pee and poop, my person's happy with me. That's what go potty means. Now, I do distinguish get busy from get more busy. So typically a dog is going to pee first when you take them out to use the bathroom. So I tell them get busy, they sniff around, and then they pee. And I go, good, get busy, good, get busy. Now, one thing to be cautious of here is don't get so excited that they break, they stop going to the bathroom and they want petting or they get all excited, right? It usually is calm, especially if you're struggling with it. The first time they go, I just go, good, get more busy, atta girl, good, get more busy. And then once they're done peeing, I say, now get more busy. And usually first thing in the morning and then right before bedtime is when they're going to have to poop. They may not have to do it through the day. Sometimes they will, but usually not. But I always want to give them that chance, right? You have to get more busy, get more busy if you need to get more busy. And I'll just encourage that. If they do it, great. If they don't, that's okay. Now, if I know they need to go, then I'll be more patient, right? Another thing that you may consider is they could be impacted. You may want to take some steps to help them get more busy. There's some things you can do with that. I'm not going to go into them in depth here, but you could look it up online or talk to your vet. If they're impacted, you may need to help them kind of get moving again. If you hold it too long, that can happen. All right. But don't encourage the command until you're at the location that you want them to actually go to the bathroom in. And the more obedience you start putting in before that, number one, you're going to have a better trained dog with you when they're just moving around your house and wherever it is you go. But number two is you're going to start separating that get busy or go potty command from, ooh, we're just getting to go outside and run around for a few minutes. So I hope that's been helpful for you guys. If you want more information on how we do this and more details, check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on our Canine Academy banner there. You can check out all of our course options. The basic course is for your basic obedience. The intermediate course covers more like agility and working on obstacles. And the advanced course takes you all the way up through off-lead obedience with your dog. So you can check that out. If you're interested in a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. Don't forget, through December 20th, if you contact me, we have $500 off our puppies. We have a couple of litters coming. It can be on a dog that we have on ground, or it could be on the reservation on one of our upcoming litters. So if you're interested in a Belgian Malinois, a German Shepherd, or a Dutch Shepherd, you will also get a free advanced course to Canine Academy, so you can do all the same training we do with our dogs, and that is available at Fortress Canine. You can click on the consult there, send me a message, or you can text me at 813-836-9244. Until next time, remember to train hard and stay safe.
I just want to add a little bit about why this is a good idea. And the younger the dog is, the easier it will be to do. Before the dog has this problem, because if a dog is holding it for 2 days, there's some anxiety issue or something there. And usually pups don't have that problem. This is something that happens in time. The dog begins to, like one way might be that, hey, when they put me out, they're going to leave and I don't want them to leave. So maybe if I don't go, or they don't even know why they're not going, that anxiety is like tightening the sphincter, right? And so they don't go. So once you condition this, and like he says, get busy. I've always said go potty. I used to say take a shit, and I realized, well, if I'm going to be in public, some people might think, so go potty, right? It really is as simple when they're young, when they're just going, is whenever you see, like, the best way you can do this, in my experience, has been a dog will show you that it's about to go to the bathroom before it actually squats or lifts a leg. There's certain motions, and as soon as you see that behavior in your animal, you know, observe it first, and then like you'll know, like he's gonna poop, that tail starts doing that twitching up or whatever, go potty. And they're gonna do it anyway, so when you say it and they do it, it starts to form that Pavlovian link. And what you'll notice is once you do that, when you take that dog out and you say go potty, you'll see, even if it doesn't immediately go, you'll see that behavior. Like with Max, when I would say go potty, you'd see that tail start to arc up, like, and that butthole start to pucker, like, I'm going to have to poop, right? And then the only way he wasn't going to go is if he literally not only didn't have to, he didn't have anything in the chamber. And the reason you want this is many. When you're trying to leave and you're going to be gone a while and you don't want the dog to go in the house, it's very convenient to be able to walk the dog out and go potty, and they go potty. Same thing at night. When we're going to bed, and it's like, I don't want to be woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning to take a dog out to take a dump. I'm going to get up at 5 anyway. Let me sleep till 5. You should be able to make it. When I take those girls out, I'm like, potty. And they know they're not getting back in the house until they at least give it the good old Chicago try, right? Like, when you're traveling and you get out of your car to walk your dog, and you're trying to get back on the road, maybe one spouse is pumping gas and the other one's walking the dog, go potty. There is such a useful thing. I wouldn't call it a skill, just a useful thing. And, you know, like when we had the workshop going on, I can't just open the door and let Belle out. It's not a good idea. So the ability to walk her outside, go potty now. And even though all this stuff's going on, this is something normal, and so she just go. And there were several people that in the morning when I would take her out, like, potty now, and it was like instant. They're like, wow, that must be handy. Yeah, it is. So I encourage you as a dog owner to work on this. And even if your dog's older, it's easier when they're younger. But if there's no problem, it's actually really easy. Just do that. Tell them to potty when you know they're going to do it anyway. And then say, good potty. Because that was the big thing. Biggest thing I've learned from Joel, instead of good dog, good girl, good skill. Sit. Dog sits. Good sit. Right? Lay. Dog lays. Good lay. That has been a game changer for me, that one little tiny thing. Anyway, let's now talk about picking out a rifle for a young girl with Mike Melito. I think this is a great subject to talk about.
What's going on, TSP? Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast, answer gun and gun-related questions. Got a pretty cool one today. The bottom line up front, what kind of rifle should I get for my 12-year-old granddaughter for deer hunting? Fantastic question. So excited. He goes into detail on the question that he has taken her hunting a couple of times, wants to get her own rifle. She's 5'3 and 90 pounds. My first thought for this is a 243. I love the 243. I think it's one of the best deer cartridges, period. Not just for 12-year-old girls, not just for women, but period. It's a fantastic deer round, end of sentence. I'd also recommend 708, the 6.5 Creedmoor. If that offends you, if you think it's going to make you have a man bun and drink soy lattes, then I'll call it the 260 Hornady Improved or something. It's a good round, especially good for whitetail, and it's a low recoil round. And even if you don't reload, there are some light loads, factory loads, for the 308, and she'll probably grow into it. So I'd throw in the 308. 243, 708, 6.5 Creed, 308. But wait, there's more. He goes into detail. He lives in a straight wall state. He says he loves the 350 Legend. If you're not familiar, some states, because they are overrun with deer or whatever reason, they have expanded their primitive weapon seasons or added another season, gone from shotgun only to straight wall cartridges. I do not live in one of these states, and I'll be honest, this makes me kind of sad. Just trust me with a regular rifle. Just obey the safety rules. Know your target and consider its background being one. That said, the 350 Legend is a good cartridge. Now, I don't have a granddaughter, but I'm going to answer this as if it was my granddaughter. 350 Legend is a fine cartridge, and it's popular for now. They've already come out with a 400 Legend, a 360 Buckhammer. Who knows when they'll come out with a 355 Legend, a 3500 Legend, you know, who knows? And who knows if this 350 Legend will be around in a decade or two. Hopefully she'll still be hunting. You go on to state that your farthest shot is 125 yards. Well, again, if it were my granddaughter, I would get a 357 Magnum carbine. I would get one that she would hopefully treasure for the rest of her life and maybe pass down to her grandson or daughter. And to me, that would not be a 350 Legend because I don't know if it's going to be around then. New cartridges pop up and they're the cartridge du jour for a little while and they go away. Even if they're a good cartridge, they just die. Pretty sure the 357 Magnum is not going to die. 125 yards is about the limit of what I would say is a decent range for the 357 Magnum. But you said that's your max range, so fits like a glove. Low recoil on a carbine. My number one thought on that would be get a Ruger 77-357. Stainless steel, bolt action, iron sights, you can mount an optic, light, handy, bolt-action rifle. That probably would be what I would get. However, there's a lot of lever lovers out there. A good lever action, like a Marlin, like a Winchester, you can still get the Winchesters. If you think she's really going to take care of it and treasure it for the rest of her life, which I hope she does, a lever action 357 I think would be a good choice for this. So if she goes off at some point to be on her own, goes to college, whatever, I'm not saying a 357 lever action is the equivalent of an AR-15, but it's a decent truck gun. It's a decent gun to have if you're only going to have one gun. You could do a lot worse. So 125 yards, straight wall, young girl, deer hunter, but something she could have for the rest of her life. And to be honest, even if you get a lot more guns, who wouldn't want to have a bolt action or lever action 357 Magnum? So that would be my pick. I hope that helps. I bet Jack will have some feedback on this as well. Thanks for the question. Thanks, Jack, and thanks, TSP. Have a blessed day.
My first response to that is, get out of my head, Melito. Really. I'm sitting here right now, and as I was listening to him talk about rounds like the 243, etc., which I completely agree with, I was like, well, I'm going to throw another option in here. And so I'm sitting here looking at this Ruger's webpage for the 77357. I looked it up before he said it, before even he mentioned the straight wall thing. I didn't read this question. I saw it was for him and the gist of it and sent it off to him. I didn't even know that was part of it. And I'm looking up the same gun. And my other thing, though, that I would say is the 357 is a great round. I have this gun. I own a Ruger 77357. I have killed quite a few deer with it. It has never let me down. It is like a laser beam out to 100 yards. The drop at about 120, 125 yards is a couple inches. And that is basically line of sight shooting out to that distance. The recoil, even on the hottest magnums you can put into it, is meaningless. But I'll tell you, they also make a 77-44. It's got more knockdown power, and the recoil is not anything to worry about, and she could certainly spend most of her time practicing with it shooting 44 specials. And both rounds are incredibly easy to reload, even if you're talking like hand reloading press, one you hold in your hand. You don't even need high-end equipment to reload either of those rounds. So I would say that. I would also say in his lineup, 243, that was the first place my head went, was 243. And like, if you grow, like you grow into that rifle, and there's no reason that you have to upgrade it. Like, it will, like, anybody can use a 243. It is the number one rifle used in Wyoming for pronghorn hunting. Now, I don't know if that's still the case. That's probably 15 years old, that statistic. But that statistic goes back another 20 years. Now we do have 6.5 Creed and all these new ammo rounds and everything. But for historically speaking, it was, if it could kill a pronghorn, it'll kill a whitetail. You know, the only place I would say you start to maybe want a little bit more thump is if you get into very far north. Like, you get up where whitetail bucks are, you know, routinely well over 200 pounds. And still, I don't think it's a problem. I really, especially at the distances you're talking. We're not talking about hitting some at 300 yards here. Because one of the reasons that 243 is so popular for pronghorn is because it is very flat shooting, well past 200 yards. So it's everything you need and more. So I just want to point out that basically Mike and I are two very different people. I really respect him. I really like him. But the only thing I know about Mike is what I've learned from listening to him answer questions. I've never had yet the opportunity to sit down and have a beer with him. I'd love to someday. We're not buddies. We don't hang out. That's my point. We're very different people. Gave me the exact same answer. Different backgrounds, different viewpoints on guns, but in this scenario, literally the same guns. The only thing I would say is, when you're deciding if you're going to go like with the 357 or a 44 with a bolt or a lever gun, where do you see her hunting taking her in the future? I want to put her into the platform that she's going to be using long term. And if you see her in, you know, when she's a young woman at 22, if she's still into this because you've set her on the right course, if you see her with a Remington 700 mountain rifle over her back, then go with the 77, 357, or 44. If you think she's going to stick around, like locally, where that straight wall is going to matter, then I don't think it matters as much. And if she, you know, I'd say also, what is she like? But I do think there is a tremendous amount of utility in a person learning to be good with a bolt gun. So that just tells you how I would angle it a little bit. But in the end, it's your choice. And I just want to say kudos to you, man, to have a young girl that interested in hunting, that she wants to continue doing it with her father. You're doing it right. All right. Next up, we have a question on thistle and teasel. And, of course, that went to Carrie Brown. What is teasel? Don't worry, you're about to find out.
Hey, TSP community. Carrie here from Strong Roots Resources. And I want to bring you guys a little bit of a compare and contrast of thistle and teasel. They're two very different plants with differing qualities, a little bit of overlap, but not a whole lot. So this all started when I was driving through Western Virginia on a little road trip, made a pit stop and saw a bunch of plants going to seed in a ditch, kind of in a, I'd say it was kind of like a culverted area. So rocky, disturbed soil, not the best environment. And it caught my eye because it looked initially at a distance like thistle. It had the, had the tall seed head, but it was enclosed. It hadn't released its seed yet, like thistle already has down here. And so I did a cheat, looked it up on one of the apps, and shows up as teasel, specifically Fuller's teasel. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. So I broke off a few of the seed pods, tied them up in a bag, and continued on my way. And when I had time and I got home, started doing a little bit of research because I just had not seen that plant around here before. Before I go too far here, teasel is invasive in East Tennessee. So I'm not going to plant these, even though it does have medicinal qualities. I'm not going to add this to the problem around here because there's actually a pretty good chance I'll find it. I'll find it somewhere if I want to harvest the roots. So let me kind of break down the differences between the two, because once you train your eye, you're going to be able to see the differences even from a ways away, but it would be easy to confuse them initially. So teasel is a biennial, same as the thistles are, but it's going to be much taller. It's got a more architectural and stiff upright position, and the rosette, so the part that is closest to the ground, it has long and smooth edge leaves, whereas the rosettes on thistle are spiny. They're very spiny. The leaf arrangement on teasel, the leaves are opposite one another, and on thistle, they alternate as they go up the stem. Another factor that'll help you distinguish this, leaves on teasel are long, they're shaped like a lance, and usually do not have lobes. The leaves on thistle have lobes. They are jagged and they are very spiny. For the leaf texture, they are rough on the teasel, but they're not fuzzy. And a lot of the times, leaf texture on thistle, on the underside, will be fuzzy or kind of woolly looking. And then finally, for leaf traits, on the teasel, it cups water around the base of the stem. The leaf curls up and it will cradle water, and on thistle, they do not do that. Now, let me jump in here real quick. I ran across some information that had people saying that because of that ability to cup water, that the teasel is carnivorous, but it's not. It doesn't have any of the other qualities of a carnivorous plant. It has no way of digesting insects. So, researchers aren't really sure why it holds and cups water, but that is a distinguishing trait to look for. And then finally, for the flower type, this is what I noticed initially. The flowers on the teasel is kind of egg or cone shaped. It was more tapered, and the flowers on thistle are very round. And while I didn't encounter this when it was in its flowering stage, pale purple to white are the colors you're going to see on Teasel. And on Thistle, you're going to go anywhere from a light purple to a deep pink. So that's kind of a quick compare and contrast of those two. I want to get a little more into a compare and contrast of the medicinal uses. So Teasel is strictly medicinal. It does not have any edible qualities. And most of the use that I was able to research comes from harvesting the root. So Teasel is going to be medicinal for connective tissue, joints, tendons, ligaments. Now that I know that, I wish I had dug some of that root, because I've been a walking connective tissue mess for a little bit now. Its qualities helps the body repair, strengthen, and re-knit those tissues. It can also help you address inflammation in the joints and connective tissue. It is slow acting, but it has a very penetrating and persistent ability to heal. And also, you know, if we're looking at chronic joint pain, tendon or ligament weaknesses, old injuries, and again, this is the root, and they're made into a tincture. So you can probably find tinctured Teasel root through any decent herbalist. These plants are, like I said, they're considered invasive, so this would be, you're not going to do any harm or degradation to harvest these plants, dig out the roots of these plants prolifically if this is something that you want to learn more about. Also, I ran across some, when I was running some of this through YouTube, found a number of good herbalist channels that were saying that it's also beneficial for nerve pain and fibromyalgia. So that's another one to keep in mind. And I think I've dug into the medicinal assistance that Thistle can provide. But real quick, Thistle, and this again is the root, this is more of like liver, lymph, metabolic support. Kind of helps the body process out toxins, filter, clear things out. And it's more of a systemic effect that you're going to get. It does reduce inflammation indirectly by improving the pathways that your body uses to detoxify, and it's more of a gradual, gentle, and steady way of going about that. Like anything, these are things that you want to research deeply. There's always a chance of, you know, medication interactions. So, you know, find yourself a good, competent herbalist. Do your, do your research. I don't think these are things that I would just grab a tincture and go for it. But I am going to talk to some herbalists that I know here locally and see if Teasel tincture is something that would be beneficial for the way I keep wrecking my wrists and my hands. So I hope that's useful to you guys. Reach out to me anytime through strongrootsresources.com if I can help you understand the land better, help you understand what's going on with the plants and the landscape, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
Well, when putting this show together, I definitely learned some things today other than this one thing, but I always say you should learn this one thing every day. The fact that something called Teasel exists and what it is and what it does, that could easily be my one thing for today. I had that because I didn't just not know it. I had no idea about that. So that's a really interesting thing to me. All right, let's talk about this app that I recently found called Fishbrain. Now, the way I found this, I was actually watching a video of a guy fishing in the Fort Worth area. And he was not promoting the app, I promise you. If this was product placement, it was expertly done, and well done, sir, then. He just mentioned how he found the spot was the Fishbrain app, and I'm like, well, what's the Fishbrain app? And I looked it up. It said try it for free, and I installed it on my phone, and I opened it up, and it immediately asked me if I wanted to sign up for a free trial for 3 days. So I didn't like that at first, but I read the terms of the trial. Please always do this. And the terms were that you can cancel any time, but you need to cancel within 24 hours of the next rebuild. Well, what that basically means is you need to cancel by the second day, or you're going to get charged for that annual subscription, and then you're debating with the App Store people or whatever. So I would say try it, and then if you decide, like don't download it and activate it until you know you have some time to play with it. And when you play with it in your area, then see if there's enough meat to it for you and what you're going to use with it, and then decide if you want to keep it or you want to use it and then, you know, just see some things and then cancel and not pay any money. It's about $80 a year. I think that was about the price. And that was my plan. And after playing with it for about an hour, sitting on the couch and doing something in conjunction that I'm going to talk about, which is really useful, which is once you know the spot, look it up on maps and go into like the satellite view, and because that's there, but because it's got all this symbology on it, like places people caught fish and heat maps and stuff, you can't actually see things as clearly as you might be able to just from the satellite view on Google Maps. And then you can also, of course, with Google Maps, switch to the street view. And this is a great, like what I'm doing for the winter, I'm making myself like scouting maps, like all the places I want to go check out. And the two of those together help me figure out, like, when I get there, like, where do I park and things like that. So far, I'm finding this thing incredibly useful, and that's why I've decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to let the charge go through, which will be tomorrow. I don't have a lot of experience with this yet, but it's enough to know it's valid, right? So I'm going to let the charge go through, and then I'm going to cancel the renewal. And at the end of a year, if I decide I want to keep it, I can obviously turn it back on. I will tell you that I also did some research, though, so you might want to leave this into consideration. Maybe set a reminder a week before so you remember to check. Because when it came out, it wasn't $80 a year, it was $40. And I know exactly what they're doing, and they're not wrong. The more people that use it, the more valuable it is. And the people that got it for $40, they're rate locked in. So I may set my reminder for like around Thanksgiving next year, and then I'll decide if I want to keep using it or not. Maybe I'll suck enough out of it that I won't care, or maybe I'll talk about some other reasons I might want to keep it. It is used by boaters. I definitely have checked out some of the lakes around here, larger lakes like Eagle Mountain, Job Pool, etc., and I guess it would be okay for that. But not that big of a deal, honestly, because those bigger lakes always have like reports, angler reports, and what's hitting and what's not, and you don't really need that data there. And I'm also going to tell you, if I'm a boating fisherman and I put a little dot, this is where I caught my fish, it is highly likely it's not going to be exactly where I caught the fish. Especially when you get into fishing for things like crappie, white bass, structure-relating fish. If you have a honey hole, you don't want to reveal where that is. So you're probably less like, but what is really great for is bank fishermen. Especially because a lot of times when you go out to a place, maybe it's not doing well, maybe there's a lot of people there, and it's good to bounce around and know a few places in a general area. So if something washes out or just isn't right at that time, or you get there and the kids are doing something with some kind of event, running in circles around the pond screaming or something, you can go somewhere else. Or you get somewhere and the way the wind's blowing is really bad for the location, or whatever reason you want to go somewhere else. It's nice to have multiple places you can go. And if you're not familiar with an area, this will speed up finding it really, really quickly. The way that it's so effective is all the data is user driven. So every catch, right, is somebody that actually caught a fish, took a picture of a fish, and said what they caught it on and how big it was and what kind of bait they were using and what kind of setup and all that stuff. But it also has you have a profile, people comment, just like Facebook or whatever, except it's just an app. And what that means is they're using social media for good if you are the person that wants the data. Because people get that dopamine hit when they post their picture and all that shit. People are doing it because I'm going to be honest. I'm probably not going to be that great of a user for the company other than I'm a paying customer. I want the data. I don't necessarily want to give away my spots. So I don't know that I want to contribute to that. But plenty of people are doing it and it's working really well. They're gamifying reporting the spot. Another thing I love about it, I mentioned Google Earth or Maps, Satellite View, whatever. There's a lot of places that I found on, Google Maps, and I did a whole show on how to find these little pockets of water and all, that I use maps, and I, start with the map view, and you look for blue, that's water, and then you go to the satellite view, and you zoom in, and you're like, can I access that? Is it there? I found a bunch of places that I was unable to find that way. in the map view, they're not even blue. Or if they are, when you switch to the satellite view and you look at the area, you don't really, you're like, if that's 30 minutes away and it's not near something else, I'm not going to drive up there to even check it out because it doesn't look like there's anywhere to park or anything. There's no way to access it. Well, when you see that like 40 different people caught fish in that spot, there's a way to access it, and you're not going to get thrown in jail for going there for trespassing. And then by reading the comments people post with their fish and the questions that they, people ask them and their comments back, you're able to determine things like, well, exactly where should I park? That I found that to be very useful. I think it would be, I would enhance the app if I owned it by actually having people give more data like that if they wanted to voluntarily anyway. And this would be beneficial. And this is where you might actually get me to start telling you where to go, because if there's a place that is on the edge of, like, we're allowed to fish there, but there are people that maybe could change that, then if there's a way that everybody's doing it now and everybody's okay with it, then I would want the next person to know, like, park here and enter this way. Because a lot of times what happens with some of these other bodies of water, it's not that you can't fish there. It's that if you start tracking through other people's property instead of a way that is using an easement or a property owner who doesn't give a shit if you do that, that doesn't ever become a problem. No one ever calls the department and making you sad, and we don't lose a place to fish. So I think that would be a good addition to it. But the way it is now works really, really well. But my bigger point is you will find places that you're not going to find with Google Maps. A lot of the places that I found, when you switch to the satellite view and you know where you're looking, you can see that there's water there. But if it's not blue on the map view, and you're on that satellite view and you're just checking the area, it's really hard to see because of darkness, shadowing, trees that are surrounding it, and things like that. So I found that to be incredibly useful. Again, you can see what's been caught, users post pictures, and you can sort by type. So you can see, like, I mean, this is Texas, right? So every place is loaded with pictures of bass, largemouth bass. You know what? I don't care. I don't get mad when I catch a bass or anything. I don't really specifically target bass. I like catfish. I like white bass, right? I like different perches and bluegills and things like that. Again, if I see bass in an area, if I see a bass-looking area, I might put some stuff on and throw to it, but that's not what I target. So it's nice that I can do things like see, well, what are the weird things that have been caught there? Like different types of perch, right? They aren't really perch. We all know that, but that's what we call them. You're like brim in Florida, perch in Texas, you know, sunnies in Pennsylvania. It's just a term. But you see things like gar and drum and things like that, which I think is really cool. And it also tells you the weather conditions and shows like the average peaks and valleys in catch time. Like what time of year, what time of day do the most people catch fish at this place? Now, you would think very intuitively that the most valuable thing about that is you know exactly when to go, and it might be to some degree, but there's something else involved. Generally speaking, as long as the place is a good place to fish, and we're talking smaller bodies of water, we're not talking 7,000, 20,000, 60,000-acre lakes. We're talking 1-acre, 2-acre park ponds. We're talking 3/4-acre park ponds. We're talking small rivers and streams that most of the water is really shallow and the fish hold into deep holes. Most places like that, you can catch fish any time of day. So if you see that the peak there is midsummer in the evening, it's probably not because that's just the best time to fish or just a good time to fish. It's what? When the most people are fishing there. So if you have freedom because of your job, your schedule, etc., to fish at non-peak times, you can kind of figure out the windows of when the least people are there. Here's an example. There's a place that I fish, a little park pond in White Settlement. I catch a ton of bullheads and perch there to put into my systems. It is a fantastic place to fish for stuff like that. I've also caught some big channels and some decent-sized bass in the place. But mostly it's bullhead catfish and various like green sunfish, long-eared sunfish, bluegills, hybrids thereof, and it's so over populated that they're literally stunted, especially the sunnies. They're so stunted, I stopped taking them out of there for anything other than feeding my channel catfish because they don't grow even when you start feeding them. They've genetically selected for dwarfism because it's so overpopulated. Okay? If I go there on a decent day for fishing at 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to catch fish like crazy. Okay? I already know this. I also know if I go there in the summertime after school hours, I'm also going to catch fish like crazy. But I also know what? I know that there's nobody there at 9 o'clock in the morning any time that I go during the week. I never see anybody there. Maybe I see one or two people walking dogs on the walking path, but nobody's fishing. So that's why there's no report. Now, it's only because I know that that I can intuit that. But that means that it's highly likely there's other places like that as well. I'll tell you another thing I like about it being a paid app. The people doing it are serious, and the number of them is somewhat limited, because I don't necessarily know, with all these little honey holes I'm finding about it, that I really want that many more people to know about it. So that kind of keeps it inside a paid group. Additionally, the way that you can actually reduce pressure on any individual area is if everybody knows five or six places instead of one or two places, and they have options, and they drive to a place, and they just look and go, there's too many people here, they have another place to go to, so they don't just pile on. So I think overall, this is a really cool app. And it also makes me wonder, like, what are some other niches that can be exploited with apps using this model? So if you're an app developer, but fishing's not your thing, maybe, you know, take a look at this, considering a marketing expense for a year of subscription, and go check it out, and then see if you can figure out something you can do similar to it. I think there's a lot of apps like this already, but niches are unlimited, so opportunities are also unlimited. And the final thing, and most of y'all probably already know this already, but there's new people coming to the show all the time. I don't shill stuff like this. I don't have any relationship with these people. I do not know who designed it. I found this thing a couple days ago. It just worked really well, and I needed something to share with you today that was easy to share because of my voice. That's it. I don't get anything. So, but I have put a link where you can learn more about the app in the show notes today. But again, if you just go on your Android or your Apple phone, you know, either App Store, and type in Fish Brain, all one word, you'll find it. You'll find it. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. It also has these hot maps, like certain areas that are really, really hot zones. You'll see like these orbs on the map. That's kind of cool too. But man, did I find some places. And what I really found is I found several places where there's access to creeks, small rivers, or ponds that I had previously located with maps, and I never even checked them out because I looked at like Street View and stuff on maps and went, I don't think I can legally access this place. Well, when 40 different people do, then you know you can too. I also found several places that would have fit that criteria had I ever found them, but I never found them. And some of them are 10 to 15 minutes from my house. And after living here 13 years, I still had no idea they existed. I think this is a really cool thing, and I definitely think you guys that fish anyway should check it out. Because one of the reasons we don't do things we love, like fish and hunt, is time limitations. When you can throw two rods and a little pack of tackle and maybe some bait in a cooler in your car, And head out after work, or if you're going in late, maybe a couple hours in the morning or something, and you can do that just 10 to 15 minutes from your house or your place of work, then you'll do it more. Yeah? And then one last thing. I think the fact that this thing works across the whole country is even more useful if you're the kind of person that travels and drives when you travel. Traveling job where you drive? Well, if you're a fisherman and you take gear with you, when you have your downtime, you can find spots that you're not familiar with the area in. And just even when you take dedicated trips, like I know a lot about surf fishing. Surf fishing is one of my passions. JR and David and I just went surf fishing 2 weeks ago. And the water was just really, really rough with heavy current. Too much so to really enjoy our. The first night was okay. Second night, it was just too much flow on the beach, too churned up. And we ended up finding some places on the backside of the island in the bayside that were better to fish by asking some people, and it was fine. But boy, I wish I would have known about this app 2 weeks ago, because we could have found dozens of hidden little gems with this app. So I think it's really cool. Anyway, with that, I have wrapped up. I hope you guys enjoy your weekend. I will be back on Monday with the final live episode of the show for the year. And then after that, we will have the Christmas special on Tuesday, and then I'll be gone until January the 5th, I think it is, the first Monday of the full week back from the holiday. And so I'll bid you adieu at that point, and I just want to, again, encourage you to really enjoy your holiday season this year. Please do. Spend it with family and friends. Make the most of the time that you have. If you have downtime, put it to good use, but don't put it necessarily to work. All right, if that makes sense. And again, remember, I have some really great items of the day this week, not the least of which, though, if you are a last-minute shopper for somebody that's like into the outdoors and EDC and stuff, the Olight, O-L-I-G-H-T, all one word, Arkfield, A-R-K-F-E-L-D, Arkfeld, I guess, Ultra EDC flashlight. This thing is the bomb. My buddy David showed me his on that trip down south. First thing I did when I got home was I bought one in the truck on the way home because JR was driving. I sit in the passenger seat, looked it up, like boom. Next day it was there. So these things ship fast for most of you. I mean, that has to do with your warehouses around you and all. But check it out. I think you'll really like it. Some other good stuff this week. And my book is still on sale, so consider that as a gift as well. By the way, it's on sale for a couple more days. Next week on Monday, I'm going to put the prices back to full price. So if you want to get it while it's on sale, you have a couple more days to do so. Take care, guys, and have a great weekend.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month.